I used to read the morning story on the BBC. BBC stands for Better Be Clean. So I know how to behave.
What's the morning story?
Well, every morning in England on the radio, there's a thing called the morning story. And it's read by different actors, you know, Ben Kingsley, you know, sort of Davy Jones and different people. And it's over the years. And as 11, 12-year-old, 13-year-old, before getting into television in England, I used to read the morning story. And the morning story comes from Manchester this morning. And the storyteller is 12-year-old Davy Jones.
And how did you choose the story?
They gave me the story, and I told the story, and I read the story. But I love to tell stories. I tell stories all the time.
So it was like an Aesop's fable or something like that?
Not so complicated. No, it was something that was written by somebody like one of the prominent sort of English writers, respected. And it's a story coming today from Manchester, you know, and it was also... We were walking down the street one day, and Nobby said to me, "Hey, look over there. Let's go check that out," you know. And then it'd be just all that. I'd say, "All right, oh, I can't believe this. Look at this," you know, and whatever it was. And it was just so you had to put some expression into it and this, that, the other. And that's how, for me, I started in radio with the BBC. And that's how some of the producers acted almost like agents. So they heard this 12-year-old boy from Manchester reading the morning story, and they said, "Wait a minute. We'll talk to Vivian Daniels in Leeds because he's doing a play on the television next week and they're looking for her." And it happened like that. Then all of a sudden I'm at Alexander Palace in London doing another TV show. And then finally I became a player on a show in England, which is the longest running soap opera in England and maybe in the world, called Coronation Street.
Uh-huh.
I became one of the main characters' grandsons.
Coronation Street, was that kind of like a soap opera?
Yes, it was exactly like a soap opera. And there was all these different characters in it, you know. There was like nasty old lady, and this guy was, you know, trying to hit off with somebody else on the street. And there was a pub called The Rover's Return. In fact, I just went back to England a couple of months ago, and I did a program called The Kids from Coronation Street. And they had all the kids, or a lot of the kids, that had appeared on Coronation Street over the last 40 years. And one of the boys, in fact, this is interesting, one of the lads was a piano player who played piano on the actual program. Well, he was taken under the wing of a lady called Violet Carson, who was also a piano player and was on the show and was my grandmother. She introduced him to some people. He started taking really, really important classes, and he is now the head of music at Cambridge University. And I became a monkey, you know what I'm saying?
Yes,
you know, it's
yeah.
Like the mafia. Once you're in, you know. It's ruined my acting career. I mean, no one's ever going to look at me. That's why I'm such a clown all the time, because I have to laugh at it, because nobody really knows what I do. You know, it's sort of like the most... I always say, people keep telling me, "Why don't you do commercials? You hear your voice. Everyone knows your voice." You know, I'm in an airport, people turn around and go, "Hey, how you doing? You know, you're Davy Jones." "Yeah, yeah, right." And it's the voice that does it. So they said I'm the most unused, recognizable voice in America. But that's over.
Mm-hmm.
We're on to this moment now. This is more important to me than anything, to be able to entertain the listeners so that they can feel a little bit of my fun and enjoy a bit of my life. I wake up in the morning and I say, I love my life. I have racehorses, I train horses, I ride horses, I gallop horses around racetracks, I go to the receptions, I've collected many prizes in the ring. I've been ridden a winner myself on the racetrack in England. I went back, it's 10 years ago now, I went back because my kids were saying, "Dad, you know so much about horses, why don't you go ride one yourself then?" Well, I ride at home all the time, I exercise and I train them, so I went back to England, I spent 6 months in a stable, and... I rode every day a number of horses, and then the gate opened at Lingfield Racetrack, and they couldn't catch the little monkey, you know. It was a joke in the beginning, but as soon as we turned for home, I went 6 lengths clear, kept my head down, kicking and pushing, and I said, "That's how you do it."
You live in Pennsylvania, right? And
yes.
You raise horses
I have
there.
Horses in Pennsylvania. Now, I will be raising horses there soon because I have 3 mares in foal, all to the same stallion, Irish bred. Now he's standing in stud in Ocala, Florida. I have a summer home or a winter home down there, and I take my horses down there sometime at the end of December, and we stay down there till the end of May. We race at Tampa, Calder, Gulfstream, and then I come back and we race at... we just won a nice little race at Delaware Park with Indian Town Jones, the same name as the town that I live in down there. I've just won a race with him at Indiana Downs. You got to understand, a six-year-old that was a maiden, not won a race. But, you know, I take my time with my horses. And I never race a two-year-old. Sometimes they're four before they race. The reason being is that, you know, I want to see them have a good career. I want to hit Saratoga. I want to go to Arlington. I want to do Gulfstream. I want to Belmont Park. And I want to take Indian Town next year to Del Mar in California. So these are long-range plans. It's sort of like, you know, the longevity of a career. You got to understand that most careers go way up and then all of a sudden they go flat down. And unless you've got the guts and the strength to climb back up again, as most artists do, they start to climb up that fishbowl and they get halfway up there and then they just settle for that comfortable place. And I feel that that's the place that I'm at. I'm in the fishbowl, but I'm not sort of down there catching the scraps. And I'm not got my head over the top of the hill there. But I'm somewhere in the middle. I work constantly. I do a lot of shows. I do a lot of fairs and parks and Disney Worlds and Knott's Berry Farms. And then, you know, I'll be on the Howard Stern Show, you know, judging a breast contest. So, I mean, it's a very interesting, but it's how you do it. That's the secret to being successful and being satisfied in show business. You know, I was telling you about Smither. He's my assistant. He's my man, you know. He's, you know, like, he's an English butler. He's a horse trainer. He's bodyguard. He's all those things. And his name is Mr. Smither. And Mr. Smither is known as Mr. Smither by everybody I know. And, you know, I joke with him all the time, say, Smither, I'm depressed. Please go kill yourself, you know, just as a joke. You know, he makes a good cup of tea and he works like a Trojan, you know. I mean, he's like so busy. He's always doing this, that, the other. He's like in his 60s. He's got a beautiful family, a wife and grandchildren and daughters and sons. But, you know, he sort of looks after me, you know, and there's always got to be, it's like being, you know, like fatherly, although he's only 6 years older than me, 5 years, I think. But, you know, he's got his own life. He likes to go to the pub and play darts every night, and I don't. I go to the pub once in a while. In fact, I just did the thing there for TV Land, you know, A Day in the Life that's going to be on in March. And one of the things that we did, I insisted that we went down to the pub. I played darts on the darts team. You got to come down and see the boys. We've got to have a few beers and, you know, get some of that on film. It's not about getting drunk and rat-faced and falling about and being an idiot. It's about a day in the life. They wanted a beginning, a middle, and an end. I said, but there is no end. Okay. There's only a beginning and a middle. I have not been on TV Land, but I was nominated for a couple of awards. The first year I was nominated for, you know, most memorable episode of a TV series. That was the time when I kissed Marsha and went to the prom.
Of course.
Everyone reminds me of that. Then I realized, you know, I got hate letters from every other girl in America because I wouldn't go to their prom. But, you know, and then I realized also all these boys were really into Marsha. I mean, they all asked me, hey, did you go out with her? And I said, no, I was 19 and she was 14, okay.
Why isn't the Monkees on TV Land? Who owns them?
It's owned by Columbia Pictures Screen Gems, and they keep it because, you know, most of those episodes cost about $15,000, $20,000 to show on the cable or the network or wherever. And that's what they were asking 15, 18 years ago. They're kind of holding on to it. They think they've got hold of the Marx Brothers or the Dead End Kids, the Bowery Boys, the Three Stooges. That's how they view the Monkees, as being a commodity that they can. Next year is the 40th anniversary, okay? Warner Brothers now hold the catalogue of the Monkees songs. They had a meeting with them a couple of days ago, and they have got all kinds of great, crazy plans and things that they want to do for the 40th anniversary. They want to package this as it deserves, with respect and with kind, so that, you know, people will, you know, get a handle of the Monkees. The people that love the Monkees and have grown up with the Monkees will want to maybe renew their record collection or their CD collection or whatever it is, their VD collection, and whatever they've got going. So they are packaging it to appeal to both the new fans and the fans that have been there supporting us for years and years.
Was your first love show business or horses?
Well, before the horses, I was in show business. I was an actor on television in England as well as on the radio. And then because of coming of age, age of 14, my mother passed away February the 10th, 1960. She was 51 years old and I was 14.
Wow.
It was time to start thinking about what to do. My dad said, that he didn't want to see me in overalls, meaning he didn't want me to be a labourer, he didn't want me to follow in his footsteps. He wanted to give me an opportunity to go out into the world, earn my own money, instead of coming home from the factory and giving him my wages and him turning around and giving me a little bit back, and then by the age of 21 getting the key to the door. You know, that's what happened in England. You know, when I was growing up, you got the key to the door when you're 21. If you weren't in by 10, you were sitting on the doorstep. My three sisters had to be in at a certain time. There's a certain respect that you had for your parents. And one of them was that you gave them your paycheck until you were 21, if you were living in the house. And they gave you spending money. And there wasn't much place to go. My sisters ran the youth club. I was in the Boy Scouts. My mum played organ at the church. Everything was featured around the neighbourhood. The policemen we all knew. The nuns came around on Friday for the newspapers and the silver paper wrappers or whatever it was. Milk was delivered. And, you know, every 2 weeks, you know, there was a soda cart that came round because my dad didn't frequent the pub and neither did my mum. Couldn't afford it. I remember going to the pub as a little kid with a jug to go get a pint of beer for my granny, you know, with threepence or tuppence or whatever it was, and walking down the street. And all these plays and things that I did were, 20, 30 years before what I was actually acting in. They were, you know, it was almost when I look at them now, and I've been sent the whole collection of everything I've done, I look back at them and it's almost like it's from the dark ages, the thing that I was involved in and the shows that I were in and the parts that I played. I've got to be enjoyed for what I do now. And, you know, that's why I play B.B. King's in New York City. And that's why I'm off to the Opera House in Delaware. And that's why in May I'll be at the Epcot Center on Mother's Day. Huh? Go figure. You know, that's good. I do it every year. I'm the only guy that goes to back there every year and have done for the last 6 or 7 years.
How many concerts do you do each year?
Well, last year I didn't do many. I did about 40 concerts. The year before I did about 80, you know, and it's been many, many more than that. But I was working on my horses because I decided they cost me so much money and I had to work so hard to meet all these expenses that I would give it one more year. And so I made a concerted effort to make sure that I was well involved with them and it wasn't, how's my horse doing today, you know, from the road. It was okay having the money, but money doesn't buy happiness. And my happiness is beating everybody on the track. You know, I want to beat everybody at all their $300,000-$500,000 horses with my $40,000 horse, which I am doing. Because it's not how you train them, how you feed them, how you keep them. It's where you place them. You keep yourself in the best company, as I am right now, and you keep your horses in the worst. And that's the secret to training racehorses. Nothing's written in stone when you're dealing with animals or when you're dealing with a career, people. It takes so many people. That's why we say we. We say we. We did this, we did that, because I have a publicist, I have a manager, I have an agent, I have band members, I have a secretary, that, you know, and a travel agent, and all these people are in my life. And that's why I can't do what I do unless I've got those people doing that.
Oh, absolutely.
We do silly, fun things. You know, we have a thing called Diva of the Month, where I sort of take Tom Cruise's head off and put my head on there, and I'm holding... I'm holding Katie. But as soon as she got pregnant, I had to take my head off again. I said, you're not blaming me for that one. So, and then I had Angelina Jolie, you know, and, you know, as soon as, you know, she was hanging out with somebody else, Brad Pitt or something, she's off, you know. And this month, I actually had a picture of me in a bath. And all
kinds. Excuse me?
Yeah, it was nothing risque. It was quite, you know, quite ordinary. And there I am in the bath with all this soap powder all over me. So I have my saxophone player is a girl. Her name is Aviva. So we put Aviva in the bath next to me, you know, so she's my diva of the month and we're having a bath together. You know, the fans know her, they know the band, you know, obviously they know the tunes.
Let's move back a little bit to when you were 16 years old,
yeah.
Because we spoke about this before
yes.
We started rolling. You were in the cast of Oliver.
Yes, I played the Artful Dodger.
Was that the original,
cast?
The original came from cast. London. Okay.
The original cast of Oliver. I was in it.
How long were you there?
I joined them in Toronto, Canada. I was there. I stayed at the O'Keefe Center and played at the, I forget where it was now. I think they changed the name anyway. But we came in 2 weeks into the run that I was part of and opened on Broadway to a newspaper strike.
Oh, geez, really?
Yeah, 1962, yeah, December. But David Merrick, smart producer, Broadway producer, he just called up, you know, Walter Winchell in New Jersey, you know, got the name out of the phone book, and it said, Walter Winchell said this is a smash, you know.
And then,
you know, George Burns thinks this is a wonderful show. And, you know, and then underneath in small print, of New Jersey. You know, Walter Winchell of Bayonne. You know, so that was kind of cool. I learned a few things from that. You know, I mean, I you know, just people believe what they hear, you know, and people what they see, you know. And that was a great experience, you know, working. In fact, then I went on to, you know, we promoting it and all that. And that was my first introduction to rock and roll, because we were invited to go on the Ed Sullivan Show. Frank Gorshin's on that show. Tessie O'Shea was on that show. You know, she was a big roly-poly lady who played a ukulele.
Tessie O'Shea.
Yeah, unbelievable. Okay. And the snake lady from Yugoslavia was on there. And four unknown guys from England, mop tops with matching boots and matching suits. And the first manufactured band, you know, the Beatles. They were all dressed the same. They all had the same Capizio boots on. They had the same haircuts. And they said things that were endearing to the public. And they were very careful, you know, until somebody dropped something in their tea and then become crazy. You know, I'm not sure what that meant for that.
or they became sane.
Oh, yeah. They became who they really were.
Right. Absolutely.
And that was that.
So you really knew when you were 19 years old, you did not get full of yourself. It didn't freak you out in any way, shape, or form, because you were just remarkably famous. You had four. There were four monkeys, but you were certainly the.
I was a heartthrob. Well,
heartthrob.
Actually,
yeah,
I was
that's
a teenage.
Good word for it.
Yeah, I was a heartthrob, but now I'm a coronary. You know what I'm saying? Forget it.
You're giving me one. That's
okay.
All I can tell
no,
you.
Heartthrob, yeah, that's fine, you know. And all these young girls, you know, it started out with, you know, Frank Sinatra and the Bobby Soxers, and then Elvis had the 15-year-olds, and then the Beatles came with the 14-year-olds, then the Monkees, you know, the 10, 11, and 12-year-olds, and the families now are watching as well. Mm-hmm. And then you got, you know, the Cowsills and Michael Jackson and all the other people came
Cowsills.
Behind that. And, you know, they all came along, and they had these, the kids were not reaching in their pockets for their money to buy gum anymore. They were buying records. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think I was a musician, but Peter Tork, you know, from the Monkees, told me, you are a musician. You can keep a beat. You can keep a, you know, you're the greatest tambourine player in the world. David Letterman said I was number one, number three, and number 10 tambourine player in the world. And then
now,
are
you still in touch with any of the other Monkees? Are they guys that you hang out with or just occasionally speak to?
No, I don't really hang out with them, and I don't, you know, occasionally speak to them. It, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you guys, maybe you do socialize when you leave here, and maybe you do go have a drink and spend some time together. But, you know, we were working from 6 in the morning until sometimes 6 at night. They'd ask at 5 o'clock at night, who's going in the studio tonight? And, you know, more often than not, it'd be me or Mickey. And so we'd go in the studio and we'd cut two or three tunes that night with, you know, the instruments have all been laid down on a track, because
sure.
That's what happens in TV. Not just TV, but in music in particular. You know, the Monkees got a bad rap for all of that. You know, when every artist at Motown had studio musicians. Paul McCartney did not play the French horn on Penny Lane, okay? And the Beach Boys never played a note in the studio, neither did the Turtles, neither did the Grassroots, neither did anybody. But we got the rap because it was a new thing, and that was that. As artists, we worked together very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were on stage, very, very well. But as friends, we never were. None of us were very friends. Mickey and I, maybe. But, you know, over the years, that kind of drifted apart because of the way each one of us developed, you know, personally, and the kind of friends and the kind of places we hung out, the kind of things we did. You know, Mickey became a director. He directed in London back in the early 80s. You know, he did Bugsy Malone on the West End stage. You know, he discovered Catherine Zeta-Jones. That was her first part on the stage. She'll always say that, too. And he did a bunch of TV shows, Metal Mickey, which he was, you know, revered for. He got a big award in England for animated children's television. Peter Tork's got his Shoe Suede Blues Band, and, you know, and he travels all around the country playing coffee houses and clubs. That's what he likes. Mike Nesmith's an entrepreneur. He brought over Masterpiece Theatre from England many, 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 many years ago. And his, you know, he's into property. His mother invented Whiteout, millions and millions of dollars. And this. So when we all left that place, you know, I went to the pub and played darts. You know, Mickey was working on his next production. Peter was trying to, you know, do his blues, and Mike Nesmith was counting his money in the money house, you know. So we all had different ideas, you know.
Now, you mentioned you have a new album coming out. You just have a Christmas album that you handed me. Your new albums are a mix of newer songs, and some of your albums have Monkees classics on them.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, are you writing songs?
Yeah, I write. I've written over 100 songs. Mm-hmm. And that was just this morning. No, I've written lots of songs. I love you this year. I'll love you next year.
I remember.
And then forever. You know, it's a wedding song I wrote for my daughter. But I write tunes, but most of it is poetry. You know, it's like every morning I wake, I think of you. Every breath that I take reminds me of the things we used to do. You're in my heart. So I was in love once. I've been married twice, and I've had a number of girlfriends over my time. But 10 years ago, I met a girl, June the 20th, 1996, and I fell in love. And we spent four years together. And, you know, it's one of those things you never forget. And I've had romances since, and I'm being loved, and I love. But being in love is another thing altogether. And romance is very important to me, especially as I'm getting older. I don't want to grow old without being with somebody. So finding the right person at the right time, and everything has to really mix and match, then is a very hard thing to do. I thought I had found, but, you know, she was much younger than I was, this particular girl, and so therefore she wanted different things than I. I've been through children, I've had all that kind of stuff, and now she's married and she has a little baby, and I think that's a wonderful thing, you know. As the song says, through the years my love has grown, still I pray you're not alone. Life's been good, I've made it through, because in my dreams I'm there with you. Oh. So those are the kinds of emotions that I go through. And it's easy being, you know, this little slap happy little guy, you know, this little monkey. And I'd go and do my concerts, and I love it. And I love to see the people enjoy themselves, and I love to see what they do. And some guy came up to me in Vegas a couple of nights ago, and this is the truth. And he said, "Thanks for keeping doing it, David." He said, "Really, I hope you're going to do it for a long, long time. You make a lot of people happy." Yeah. And, you know, that might seem like a load of baloney to someone, you know, but that's the stuff in a world of no's. I get so many yeses. So why shouldn't I not keep doing it?
You were talking about your children. How many have you got?
Four daughters.
Four daughters?
All girls.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's a remarkable coincidence.
Yeah, I got four daughters. There's Annabelle, she's 17. You know, she. It's like being bilingual when you've got a teenager. I have no idea what she's talking about half the time. She's a singer, songwriter.
Oh, really?
She's absolutely very good. She sang with me at Disney World last year for the first time. "Dad, I want to come on and sing." "Okay, I'll sing Valerie with you, Dad." "Okay." On she went. She sang that. She pranced around the stage. She's a beauty queen. She's absolutely gorgeous. I know all fathers think their kids are gorgeous, but she is just a knockout, you know. Uh-huh. And then, you know, I got my other one. She's 22. She's got a little baby. She's got Phoenix. She's not married, and she's a single mother. And she writes, and she was my tour manager for a while, a couple of years back. And, you know, she got hold of Mickey and Peter by the neck a few times and told them, you know, either calm down or you're going back to your room. You know, because she's so used to the way people react and talk to me that she was able to cope with the hysteria and such that happens. It still happens. You know, the only difference is that it's a little bit more controlled. Because, you know, you don't want me to go ripping at a, you know, a 59-year-old man. You know, you're going to hurt him. But, you know, I get love letters from all over the world, from South America, from France, Germany, England, New Zealand, Australia. And that was just this morning. But, you know, I write back. I get little 15-year-olds and 17-year-olds and older women, you know, calling and saying, you know, "Wow, I was going to marry you. My picture's on your bedroom wall. I used to kiss it goodnight every night. And I used to kiss the television when you were on," which was really dangerous in the 60s because we had those electrified carpets, you know. You go over to kiss Davey on the TV. "I'm going to kiss Davey." Ah! Oh, I know, because I got third-degree burns from watching I Dream a Genie. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, my. Oh,
now, this is true. I'm not telling a lie.
Okay, you know. I have a very serious question, which I think is very difficult for you. But what have you learned in your life that is an unshakable part of your belief system? If you can encapsulate that for us in a couple of minutes.
In one word, loyalty. Loyalty. I have no bones about someone not wanting to continue the same path as I in any direction, musically or otherwise, and I will not hold it against them. But loyalty is very important to me. I have nothing to hide whatsoever. Mm. I have absolutely nothing to hide. I try to expose myself in the nicest way, of course. I like to expose myself to everybody. I want them to know about me. I want you to remember me for this day, mm-hmm. not for the monkey that I was or the Artful Dodger or Marsha's prom date or whomever it might be. I'm referring to showbiz. And then it all comes back to you tenfold. and it comes back to you with, not necessarily monetarily, but it comes back to you with warmth and love. And who's been loved more than me, you know? I mean, it's like, forget it. I have so many people who care so much about me. I have so much responsibility to a lot of people. People that have never met me, only people that have seen me and see this image of this boy, you know, who is now a man, a father, has been a husband, you know. Don't use the past as your block for the future. Where things have happened to you in the past that you're not very nice, okay, they've happened. You've over that part. Now move on to the positive side of life and go forward, you know, and try to be the person that you want to be to yourself, first of all. You can't love anyone until you love yourself. And then just get out there and share yourself and the good feelings that you have, you know.
That is a beautiful rap.
Thank you.
I'm not kidding. I don't think you meant to go there, but that is so much the very last.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It was really a pleasure.
You could edit me anyway, aren't you?
I do have to.
Folks, please, they're going to edit me, so listen, don't forget, I love you. I'll see you again someday.
I don't think you're rolling, but I do have more time.